Thank you very much. I think my talk probably has a slightly different title to the one that was advertised, but it's kind of along the same lines. I talk too fast. I've written talk slowly here. It may or may not have any effect. Sorry if it doesn't. What I want to talk about is a view that's sometimes called dispositional essentialism. Sometimes it's kind of generically talked about in terms of a powers ontology. Stathis has kind of mentioned it in passing already. Dispositional essentialists think that the fundamental properties are what Alexander Bird calls potencies, or you might call them powers. And they think that while those potencies or powers may have some kind of categorical aspect to them, they're essentially dispositional. They have an essence that has a dispositional nature. Now, if you think that, and you think that there are... Do we need that? Am I all right without that? Oh, I do need it. Okay. if you think that the fundamental properties are potencies and they have these real essences that are dispositional, and you think that there are laws of nature, as Alexander Bird does, as Brian Ellis does, you're going to be committed to the claim that those laws of nature are metaphysically necessary. Why is that? Well, suppose we think that having negative charge is right. Thank you. Suppose we think that having... Does that make any difference?
It's not full.
Oh, I see. Suppose we think that having negative charge is a fundamental potency. If you think that, then you're going to think that it has a real essence, which is dispositional in nature. So, for example, you might think that having negative charge is essentially a matter of being disposed to repel objects that are similarly negative charge, and also disposed to attract objects that have positive charge, and so on. Well, if you think that's what's of the essence of negative charge, then you're going to think that it's metaphysically necessary that negatively charged things repel other things that have negative charge, right? That's just going to be... it would be impossible for that to be false. Anything that was negative, that seemed to be negatively charged that failed to repel other things that were negatively charged couldn't possibly be negatively charged. So it seems that you get the result that the laws of nature are metaphysically necessary. Now, question arises, well, okay, if the laws are metaphysically necessary, are they knowable a priori or are they knowable only a posteriori? And dispositional essentialists are very keen to stress that the laws of nature, despite being metaphysically necessary, are only knowable a posteriori. And what I want to do in this paper is to challenge that claim. I want to claim that if you're a dispositional essentialist, you should really think that the laws of nature are knowable a priori. So I partly want to give you the argument for why I think that, and then at the end I want to ask the question whether that's really such a bad thing. I think that dispositional essentialists shy away from that conclusion because they think it sounds terrible. Actually, I think it isn't quite as terrible as it sounds. I am no fan of dispositional essentialism, I should say, but in charitable mood, I want to claim that even if it does, as I shall argue, have the consequence that the laws of nature a priori, actually that's not a kind of reductio of dispositional essentialism. Okay, so here's Alexander Bird's derivation of the necessity of the laws, which is kind of, Stathis has got it over there. I'll explain all of this in a minute. Here we go, let's just put all of that there. Right, now, so first premise. Says, this is a matter of stipulation, if something is disposed to do M, that's the manifestation, in when stimulated by stimulus S, something has that disposition, if and only if, were it to be stimulated S-wise, it would manifest M. Now, that's a necessary truth because it's just simply a matter of stipulative definition that that's what it is to have property D. Is to do M in situation X. So it's necessary and knowable a priori. What's going to turn out to be the controversial premise is that second one, which says necessarily if something has potency P, potencies are supposed to be the fundamental properties whose real essences are the dispositional properties. Depp says necessarily if something has potency P, then it is disposed to do M in situation X. That's supposed to be a necessary truth. I'll come back to that. Follows from those two premises that necessarily, for all x, if x has potency p and is in situation s, it will do m. Now, that's going to be a necessary truth because we've got the boxes at the top, so the box is just going to transfer across.
The claim is that that is, for all x, px and sx, therefore mx is a law of nature, turns out to be metaphysically necessary. The claim that dispositional essentialists want to hang on to is the claim that, despite being metaphysically necessary, it's a posteriori. Now, the only way they can get it to come out a posteriori, given the derivation, is to hold that dep itself is knowable only a posteriori, right? If dep was knowable a priori as well, they'd end up with the answer that the law of nature there is not only metaphysically necessary, but knowable a priori. That's what they want to resist. Okay, so the idea is that the disposition, that thing that we've stipulatively defined in our first premise, is the real essence of the potency. So effectively, what the dispositional essentialist, or what Alexandra is doing here, is kind of trying to drive a wedge, as it were, between the potency, that fundamental property, and the disposition that is the real essence of that fundamental property. And that's what seems to allow you to kind of distinguish between the a priori status of that first premise and the a posteriori status of the second premise. And I just, I mean, the basis of my argument is I don't see that there's any wedge to be drawn between a potency and the disposition that is supposed to be its real essence. So the question is, why should we think that that second premise, dep, is a posteriori? So here it is again. Now, there's an appeal. It's somewhat implicit, it must be said, but it's there, because I don't see any other way to do it apart from anything else, to Kripkean semantics. So think about the case of water in H2O. It's supposed to be a posteriori that necessarily, if something's water, then it's H2O. Similarly, it's supposed to be a posteriori that if something has potency X, then it's disposed to do M in situation S. And we can think of being H2O as being the real essence of water, real essence not in any sense that Locke would have signed up to, but real essence in the way that Kripke means real essence. So there's an appeal to Kripkean semantics here. There's supposed to be an analogy between the disposition case and cases like water. And what I want to argue is that the claim that what goes for being water and the relationship between being water and being H2O goes equally for potencies and dispositions is both unmotivated and implausible. Seems to me that dep looks a priori, hence it's going to turn out that that law statement is going to be a priori as well. Okay, so let's think about twin F. Kripke's claim about the a posteriori necessity of things like water is H2O, gold is the element with atomic number 79, and so on. That claim is justified, if it's justified at all, and I'm going to assume that it is, although I'm not sure that it is really, is justified by appeal to twin Earth thought experiments. So, for example, right, so we imagine a possible world or a distant planet that's very similar to the actual world or Earth, where there's stuff that flows in the rivers and the lakes and falls from the sky and so on that looks and in all sort of visible, manifest respects, is just like water. It's potable, it's colourless, and so on and so on and so on. Turns out not to be H2O at all. Turns out to be some completely unencountered chemical substance, XYZ. Now, consult your linguistic intuitions. Is that stuff on twin Earth water or not? Looks like water, smells like water, tastes like water. Underlying chemical composition, XYZ, not H2O. We're supposed to have the intuition that it isn't water, right? It merely looks like water, tastes like water, and so on, isn't water. And what that intuition, if we all have it, is supposed to show us is that that stuff is not, in fact, water, hence turns out to be metaphysically necessary that water is H2O, right? There are no possible worlds where water fails to be H2O, because no matter how similar the stuff at those possible worlds is to actual water, if it doesn't have the same underlying chemical constitution, intuitively, just not water. Okay, so we end up with a necessary truth to the effect that water is H2O, but it turns out that that truth is knowable only a posteriori because, of course, it's a matter of discovery what the essence of water is. It's not a matter of linguistic... we haven't defined water to be H2O. You come across some stuff and it's water. We've designated it as water. We've named it. What its underlying essence is a matter for chemical discovery. Turns out that not only is water H2O, but it's a matter of metaphysical necessity that water is H2O. So that's the way that you get to justify the claim that we have these statements such as water is H2O that are metaphysically necessary but knowable only a posteriori. All right. So if that's going to work... Now, the question, does that work for the case of relationship between a disposition, oh sorry, a potency, and the underlying real essence of that potency, namely the disposition to do M in circumstances S. Well, I said I was going to claim two things. Firstly, that that claim is unmotivated, and secondly, that it's not justified. The unmotivated claim is kind of easy because there are no twin air thought experiments in anything that Bird or Ellis have written on this topic. You need a twin air thought experiment, right? You can't just go around saying, here's a claim, it's metaphysically necessary, and I hereby decree that it's knowable only a posteriori. You're not allowed to do that. Well, you can do it, and what you say may be true, but you have not offered any justification for that. If you want to justify the claim that a particular metaphysically necessary truth is a posteriori, you need to give us the twin air thought experiment, and it had better be a persuasive one, right? We better have the intuition that, okay, this thing that looks a bit like the potency that we have in the actual world, but actually has a different dispositional essence, that's not the same potency, it's a different potency, right? That's the intuition you have to have. Neither Bird nor Ellis offers us... They don't set up any thought experiments or kind of offer any persuasive reason why we should think that that's the sort of intuition that we would reliably have. So, the a posteriority of that thing which is depth is unmotivated, right? No motivation for the claim that... I suppose it is a necessary truth that if something has potency D, then it has real essence D. Suppose we grant that that's necessary. We don't have any motivation for the claim that it's nonetheless knowable only a posteriori, as we do in the case of water and gold and so on. Okay, so the second worry is a worry about being charitable. Okay, they don't actually give us the thought experiments. Let's see if we can kind of concoct some thought experiments, sort of twin Earth style scenarios, and see whether it really is plausible to think that we get the intuition that something that kind of looks like it's the same potency but has a different underlying dispositional essence isn't the same potency. So, first problem, not even clear to me how a twin Earth story might go, although I'll give it a crack in a minute. And the basic worry here is it seems to me there's just too tight a connection between, we were supposed to have kind of two properties here. We've got the potency and we've got the underlying real essence of the potency, which is the dispositional essence. There just seems to be too tight a connection between those two things. You need to be able to pull those two things apart in order to get a twin Earth thought experiment off the ground. So in the water H2O case, we have a kind of nominal essence, again, not in Locke's sense. We have the watery, we have the notion of the watery stuff. It runs in the rivers and the lakes, it falls from the sky, it's potable, it's colourless, and so on and so on. And then we have the real essence, which is that it has that particular chemical constitution. Those two things conceptually can come apart. In Twin Earth, exactly what we imagine is we imagine some stuff that has the nominal essence of water without the real essence of water, right? We can find something in our imagination that has the nominal essence without the real essence, and we conclude from that that the stuff in Twin Earth isn't water. What is the nominal essence of a potency? I'm not sure. What we need is a case where we can somehow have something on Twin Earth that kind of looks like P, and yet has a different dispositional essence. Not really sure that that can be done. Not clear how the potency P can come apart in principle in the imagination from the disposition D. Okay, so here's the basic problem. The basic problem, I think, is that you just... It's very hard to see how you could designate a potency without already specifying it in dispositional terms. So I can point at that stuff and say, I hereby name that stuff water, and you kind of all know that I'm, you know, you can see it, you can drink it. That's the stuff I was just talking about. Suppose I get a lump of sugar, and I say, I don't even know how to put this. Let the disposition that that lump of sugar has, the one that I'm talking about now but not specifying, let that be called solubility. You might say, well, what disposition? Which particular disposition are you talking about here? Not very clear what I'm saying. Seems to me that the best I can do, I mean, you can't point to it and say, let that be soluble, right? You can point to the sugar and say, I name that stuff sugar, but you can't point to the property of solubility and say, I call that property solubility. Because it's just, I mean, without wanting to kind of presuppose anti-realism about dispositions, you kind of like, the designation thing is kind of a real problem here. Seems to me that the best thing that you could do is to point to a manifestation and then say, let solubility be the potency that produced that in these circumstances. So I might drop the sugar in the water, stir it around, You see it dissolving, and I say, okay, that thing that's happening right now, that manifestation, let solubility be the disposition to do what's going on right there in the glass of water. I could do that. That would be a way of, as it were, saying what solubility is, the kind of the property that I'm talking about. But it seems to me that that just now looks like stipulative definition, right? Let solubility be the disposition to do what's going on in the glass right now, viz. Dissolving in water. So it looks like I've just defined solubility as the disposition to dissolve when placed in water. And of course, that's not going to get me the right answer in the Twiner thought experiments. Because now, again, we're just not going to get any kind of gap between nominal and real essence. Twin solubility would just be solubility, right? You go to another possible world, you look at something, you think it, you know, you find some potency. You think, is this potency solubility? Well, you know, is this thing disposed to dissolve when placed in water? Yes, it is. So it's soluble, right? There's no space for you to think, gosh, this thing seems to have the potency solubility, but actually it's going to turn out not to, right? Because in order to have the potency solubility, it would have to be disposed to dissolve when placed in water, and if it's disposed to dissolve when placed in water, then it just automatically is solubility. You can't get a case where you've got the nominal essence without the real essence. There's just no real gap between those two things. Okay, here's a response you might make. Suppose we discovered that twin solubility is underpinned by a quite different underlying nature to actual solubility. That could happen. Wouldn't we then be entitled to say that twin solubility isn't really solubility? Response to that is to say, well, look, for the dispositional essentialist, the underlying nature needs to be a dispositional nature. So insofar as our different underlying nature still underpins a disposition to do M given S, then that just is the same disposition, right? We don't have a different disposition here. We have the very same disposition. Now, so perhaps the disposition essentialist could say something like this. Okay, look, what we discover could be a different dispositional nature. So let me try and give you an example where it kind of looks like maybe this might work. So imagine we've got our twin substance, call it TS. I put it in the water, it dissolves, but it only dissolves, it dissolves in a kind of different but overlapping range of circumstances to our actual soluble substance, AS, which let's suppose it's sugar, say. So TS has a different dispositional property to AS. So for example, let's just do it with an example. Suppose that our actual substance dissolves in water at any temperature between 0 and 100 degrees, right? Suppose that our twin substance only dissolves in water between 70 and 73 degrees. So I happen to have quite a warm glass of water here. I dissolve my substance in it. I put my substance in, it does dissolve. And I think, oh gosh, right, that's soluble then. And then it turns out after a whole bunch of investigation that actually it only dissolves in that very narrow range of circumstances, whereas actual things that are soluble dissolve in a different range of circumstances. Okay, so the idea here is that while our actual substance and our twin substance are both soluble in water under different ranges of conditions, the fact that they're only soluble in water under different ranges of conditions is made true by different potencies with different dispositional essences, right? So in the actual world, we have potency one being instantiated. Let's call that solubility in water. The potency that's instantiated by our twin substance is not solubility, it's another potency, call it potency P2, right? These potencies happen to have an overlapping range of manifestation conditions, but because they have a different range of manifestation conditions, they are different potencies, right? So that would be a way of, even though in fact, because I happened to put it in a glass of water that was 72 degrees, it kind of seemed like it was the same potency. Actually, it turns out upon empirical investigation that it's not the same potency at all, it's a different potency. Okay, now, I've got a kind of a long retort to this, but I think I might just kind of skip most of it. My basic worry here is, well, by what right do we say that we've discovered that P2, that property that twin substance has, is not solubility? How have we discovered that about it? What we've discovered about that thing is that it has a different range of manifestation conditions. Doesn't follow from that that we've discovered that it's a different potency. If you want to claim that we've discovered that it's a different potency, you have to claim that
according to our linguistic intuitions, you know, you look at the stuff at Twin Earth, having discovered that the range of manifestation conditions is different, that the potency that's instantiated in Twin Earth is not solubility, right? Solubility is what solubility is at the actual world. The property that we've got in Twin Earth is not solubility at all, it's some other property, right? And it seems to me that that case has not been made at all. Of course, you could stipulate that it's not solubility, but that's not what you're allowed to do with Kripke. You can't can't be a matter of stipulation. It has to be a matter of intuitive obviousness that that stuff is a different potency to the potency that actual sugar has, say. And that just, yeah, the case for that seems to me not to have been made at all. In fact, I just don't think we have very firm intuitions one way or the other about this kind of thing. Seems to me that you could just as easily say, yeah, that stuff on Twin Earth, that's soluble. I mean, it's soluble under a range of different circumstances to actual sugar, but it's still soluble, right? And if you think it's still soluble, then it looks like you're still attributing the very same potency to the thing. It's just that your concept of what that potency is one that allows for a range of different manifestation conditions. Okay, I'm going to skip all of this. This is some stuff about Laporte and Bird, blah, blah, blah. So, remember, here was the argument. The worry was about that second premise, depth. In order to get the result that the laws of nature are knowable a posteriori, we had to hold that second premise is itself knowable only a posteriori, and the worry is that we have no good reason to think that. Hence, by dispositional essentialist lights, we have no reason to think that the laws, for example, V-box, are knowable only a posteriori. Seems to me that we have perfectly good reason to think that they're knowable a priori, right? So now, that sounds bad, doesn't it? I don't know. Thinking that the laws of nature are knowable a priori kind of makes it sound like we could just sit down in our armchairs and just, you know, write the book of the universe without ever having to, you know, invent the microscope or do any kind of investigation whatsoever. Kind of sounds bad. Seems to me that it's not so bad, actually. It's not obvious that this is a terrible result for the dispositional essentialist. So, for example, think about the fact that the stipulative definitions that generate these a priori necessities are themselves prompted by empirical inquiry. I mean, if you just sat in the armchair, you would lack the conceptual resources to talk about quantum physics or chemistry or biology or any of that stuff, right? You have to go out and do the empirical work to find out how the world operates in order to kind of develop the concepts within which the laws of nature have to be stated. But more importantly, it's still going to be an empirical question which potencies are instantiated and how they're distributed, right? That's going to be a matter of contingent a posteriori truth. So kind of think of it like this. I've got all the relevant scientific concepts. So all of my concepts of fundamental properties are all dispositional concepts. And so all the laws of nature which have the form, if something has this fundamental property, then it will behave in such and such a way in such and such conditions, all of those claims are knowable a priori because they're just a matter of stipulative definition. Now, nonetheless, okay, and just imagine that you do this for kind of any conceivable potency that you could think of, right? Squillions and squillions and squillions of them. Now, here's the interesting empirical question. Which of those potencies are actually instantiated in the actual world, right? And which objects which instantiate which of those potencies? Those are the interesting empirical questions to ask, right? If you want to know how stuff is actually going to behave, if I want to know what Stathis would do if I kind of prodded him really hard, knowing all of these nice laws of nature, which I can do a priori, would help me not very much, right? Because I'd have to discover which disposition Stathis actually had. And one way I can do that is by poking him to see what the manifestation of that is. But I kind of do need to poke him or do whatever it is I have to do in order to figure out which dispositions he has. And that's what I'm interested in, right? I'm interested in the behavior of human beings and subatomic particles and chemical substances and the rest of it. So it seems to me that it's not obviously such a bad thing to think that the laws are a priori, because the things that we intuitively think of as a posteriori, there's figuring out how things work under what conditions, actually those things are still things that you need to do proper scientific empirical investigation to discover. Okay, so, not so bad. Here's a reason why a certain kind of dispositionalist, I think,
would want to resist that. And I think it's the kind that, it's certainly the kind that Brian Ellis is, and I suspect it might be the kind that Alexander Bird is as well, but he's not very clear on this point. Dispositional essentialists, and as I say, Brian Ellis is very explicit about this, tend to think that real necessity, and I've put sky quotes around real, must be grounded in a posteriority. If it wasn't grounded in a posteriority, it would just be de dicto necessity, and so it wouldn't be real necessity. It would just be a matter of the meanings of words. So, from a kind of Ellisian point of view, if you thought that the nature of the fundamental potencies was all just a matter of stipulative definition, that would show you that there was no real necessity in the world, right? It would just show you that we've defined up a whole bunch of concepts in various ways. No real necessity anywhere. It would be like, what would it be like? So I stipulatively define something as a kind of mereological sum of a pen and a bulldog clip or something. Where am I going with this thought? So the claim that, and I'm going to call them pen clips, and now the claim that pen clips have pens as proper parts, that's just, that follows a priori, right? I've just stipulatively defined a pen clip in such a way that they have to have pens as proper parts there. I've got a necessary truth. No real modality going on here, right? The modality is merely a function of the stipulative definition that I've just introduced. There's no real kind of modal force to any of this. There's nothing kind of like gluing the pen and the bulldog clip together or anything like that. That's just de dicto necessity, it's not real necessity. So I think the Ellis view is that if the laws of nature were metaphysically, were knowable a priori in that way, if we just stipulatively defined all the fundamental potencies, again, there would be no real necessity in the world. There would just be de dicto necessity, and that would be bad because kind of the cornerstone of dispositional essentialism is that disposition potencies, the dispositional essences of potencies, whatever they are a matter of real necessity. Those are the things that drive necessity in the world. It's the kind of the fundamental nature of the world having this dispositional heart to it is what gets us modality, effectively, right? So if you think that in order to construe the world as having that kind of dispositional core, if you think that that's what's required in order to have sort of real metaphysical necessity, you'd better think that those potencies are not simply stipulatively defined. Right, so if you had that kind of view, then the a priori of claims about the nature of potencies would be extremely bad, because it would turn out that there is no real modality in the world. There's just meanings of words, that's all there is. It's the only source of modality for us, and that's not good enough if you're someone like Brian Ellis. But it seems to me that the dispositional essentialists can simply reject that assumption about real necessity. In fact, I think they should reject that assumption about real necessity. That's an option that's open to you. So, for example, David Odeberg in his book, Real Necessity, I think it's called Real Necessity, that's exactly what David Odeberg does. No one can accuse David Odeberg of thinking that the necessity there is in the world, the source of modality, is merely verbal. Right? He doesn't think that at all. He's a really, really full-on hardcore essentialist about this stuff. But he thinks, by and large, that necessities are all knowable a priori. He's very, very hostile to the kind of Kripkean story. So one could go, I'm not a big fan of that way of going, but that's a way that one could go, right? You get to have the real necessity without having the a posteriority. The other thing that you could do, which Stath is briefly mentioned earlier on, is that you could just do what Stephen Mumford does and says, granted a powers ontology, there just aren't really any laws at all. You know, I just don't think that these metaphysically necessary universal generalizations deserve the status of law. So if you had that kind of view, so there's a debate about Alexander and Stephen about whether we should think that, according to dispositional essentialism, there just are no laws, or which is what Stephen thinks, or we should think that there are laws, but they're not doing anything. They're just kind of descriptions of the dispositions that they are. One reason you might have to kind of go in the Mumford direction is if it turns out that the laws, that those metaphysically necessary universal generalizations are a priori, and you think it sounds bad to say that the laws of nature are a priori, one way to resist that is merely to just deny that those metaphysically necessary universal generalizations are laws of nature, which is what Stephen thinks, right? So, okay, you've got all this, these things that are knowable a priori, but that's fine because we're not committed to think that the laws are a priori, because we didn't really think that they deserve the title law in the first place. In fact, you might think that the fact that they turn out to be noble a priori is a good reason to think that they weren't really laws in the first place. Okay, so I think whether you think it's a bad result for the dispositional essentialist that the laws of nature a priori kind of depends on your background view about where modality comes from, what the kind of essential signs of modality are, if you like, whether you think that those kinds of universal generalizations deserve the title law in the first place. So I think there are moves that you can make if you're a dispositional essentialist that will allow you to embrace the claim that those metaphysical necessities are noble a priori. Whether dispositional essentialists like Bird and Ellis want to go down that road is very much, you know, their problem and not my problem. But there is a road that they could take if they wanted to. That's it. Thank you.